It's the Season Watch Pod. I'm Heidi Holton.
This is Charlie Mitchell.
Hi, this is Prairie Creek, way down south in Northfield, Minnesota.
Hi, I'm Thor, and I think you should listen for bird calls when you're outside.
Hi, this is Warren. I think you should look out for those red-winged blackbirds.
Hi, this is Oscar, and you should look out for a deer on the side of the road.
This is Leo, and if you can, snap a recording of the dandelion life cycle, which would be pretty cool.
Hi, this is Esri, and I think you should listen to the songbirds this summer.
Hi, this is Natalie. I think you should look out for all the different types of butterflies and insects you find.
Hi, this is Ellen, and I think you should look out for the rose-breasted grosbeaks.
Hi, this is Letty, and I like phenology because it helps me connect more with nature.
Hi, this is Amelie, and I like phenology because it's taught me to look at the world in a different way.
Hi, this is Grace, and I like phenology because I learned about the different type of birds and bird calls.
Hi, this is Emery. I like phenology because it's taught me to look at how the seasons change.
Hi, this is Anna, and I think you should watch out for the herons.
Hi, this is Caroline. I like phenology because phenology surrounds you wherever you go.
Hi, this is Ingrid, and I like phenology because you can identify way more birds once you know about it.
Hi, this is Sawhill, and you should start wearing bug spray because in the summer evenings there are lots of mosquitoes.
Hi, this is Sam, and I think you should watch out for poison ivy.
Hi, this is Hank. I think you should look in the water for fish, especially bass.
Hi, this is Hugo. I think you should watch the monarch butterflies this year.
Hi, this is Silas. I think you should watch for indigo buntings.
I like phenology because it teaches me, all about the different birds and species of plants.
My name's Henry, and I like phenology because you can do it wherever you go.
Hi, my name's Ryan, and you should look for the snakes at Prairie Creek because I saw some right next to a goal.
Hi, this is Michelle, and I love phenology because it teaches us so many new things to see in our world.
This has been Prairie Creek, one last step along the phenology journey. See you next year.
Now, that was not a fake background or anything there with the birds in the background of that report, right?
Yep. They record outside a lot of time. They spend a lot of time outside at Prairie Creek, and you can tell how much it makes a difference for those kids to be outside all the time and be studying their world. Ugh, my little heart. I'm going to miss them as this, school year wraps up and we wait for them to return in the fall.
That's right. We will be hoping and asking you blatantly to be in part of Season Watch Pod and the Phenology Show because we won't have all those kids' voices this summer.
Exactly. Yeah. They said there it's one last step along the phenology journey. And while that might be true for the school year, phenology is continuing. It's a very odd thing that summer is such a beautiful time to be outside in Minnesota, and most Minnesotans, when they're thinking about outdoorsiness, summer's a huge part of it. People are up at their cabins, people are out on lakes, fishing and swimming and doing all this stuff, and yet it's the slowest season for us at the radio station because we've focused so much on K-12 schools, which mm-hmm. is great. But yeah, throughout the summer, we kind of lose a lot of those really reliable eyes throughout the state telling us what's going on in each area. And that's where we need our listeners to step up and let us know what you're seeing. You don't have to have grandkids. You as an adult can tell us what you're seeing. Send us a voice memo. We would really love to hear from you because it's just a beautiful time.
It's funny, Charlie, that you mentioned leaving a voice memo through SpeakPipe. You can find that on the podcast edition. You can find it when you look for Season Watch at kexe.org. This week, we actually happened to get a couple of messages. You ready?
I'm so ready.
Hi, this is Josh Leonard calling in from Bellin Outdoor Science down in Afton, Minnesota. And oh my gosh, there's been so many things happening. I can barely write them down. Sorry, I haven't checked in for a little while. Last week on Thursday, May 28th, we had our first monarch butterfly, and an egg was found as well, thanks to Megan. So exciting. We've been waiting for them and waiting for them and waiting for them. Finally, they showed up on Thursday last week. We have so many flowers blooming. We have a lot of prairie out here at Bellin. So we have the golden Alexanders are blooming, spiderwort, white wild indigo, black-capped raspberry, goat's beard, and golden Alexander all blooming on Thursday, May 28th. We also found our first ripe strawberry. Jeff ate it. And then we had a female grosbeak nest building on Thursday last week. The next day on Friday the 28th, crown vetch, a nasty invasive, started blooming, and oxeye daisies also blooming. They're not native. I don't know if they're invasive, but I do love them. And our first spittlebug. Such joy in spittlebugs. I love them. They're so fun. We're not here over the weekend. So then on Monday, June 1st, we saw a snapping turtle laying eggs. Hey guys, there's so much to share from Bellin. I'm starting a second speak pipe. I just thought I'd share that on Monday, June 1st, that monarch egg that we found on Thursday, May 28th, hatched. So that's right on time at about 4 days. Usually it takes about 3 to 5 days. So exciting to see that happening. And then we also had a snapping turtle laying eggs on Monday, June 1st. And then yarrow started blooming. Oh my gosh, I love that plant. So many good things to say about it. Campion started blooming, and prairie smoke got its first seed head on Monday, June 1st. I also would like to share a sad phenology report, which is the roadkill that I find along my bicycle commute between Afton, where I work, and Stillwater, where I live. It's about 11 miles. And starting from the south near Afton, I found a meadowlark fledgling, a cliff swallow, a hognose snake, a skunk kit or a young skunk, and a painted turtle fairly close to it, and then a robin, and then two more painted turtles by the Bayport Fire Department. Thank you guys so much for the work that you do. I just love listening to you guys every week, and I'm sorry I've been absent for the last few sessions.
Josh, thank you so much. We hope everybody will take Josh's lead and leave a message for us. How do you feel about this roadkill update? That's a little, I'm glad to hear it from him. It's not a cut on Josh by any means, but that tells us a lot too.
It does. Yeah. And you know, roadkill report is sad. We also heard from actually our friends at Prairie Creek Community School, those kids also have noticed that they want to be keeping a roadkill report. Because, you know, roadkill is, you know, a sad fact about our world. And I forget exactly the percentage. Let me write this down so I actually remember to bring it up next week. But road fatality is a very significant factor for wildlife. And there's actually a whole study of road ecology looking at how roads change the behavior, the population health, a whole lot about birds, animals, everything that they live near. And you can look at areas within 2 miles of roads are significantly different in terms of their ecology, the behavior of species, the composition of species compared to areas 2 miles or more away from roads. Very fascinating field of biology. There's a book that I want to read on it. I'll get there someday. But I also think because cars don't discriminate in terms of what they hit, kind of a representative sample of what's crossing the road at a given time. And so what I think would be very fascinating about something like Josh noting down everything that he's hitting is what would those records look like 20 years ago compared to now? 20 years ago, I don't think we had possums in this area. We do now. 20 years ago, were you hitting more hognose snakes? Like, that was a really significant one. I don't see hognoses that often around here. On my drive home from Grand Rapids last week, I stopped to help a turtle cross the road, what I thought was a turtle. When I went back, it was unfortunately a yellow-bellied sapsucker that was dead on the road. But that was the closest look I've ever had to a yellow-bellied sapsucker, and I got to hold it, and it was in relatively good shape. And I got to see all these markings that I never get to see, and the shape of the wing, and yeah, and then you go back to your car and you put hand sanitizer on and you go on your way. And of course, later on, a mallard hit the side of my car as I was driving, making this huge noise, scared the crap out of me. The mallard, I don't know. It's hard to know. It was still alive when I drove back to check on it. But, you know, try as hard as you might, we're kind of stuck in a car world, and this is part of what happens.
Right.
But it's interesting data, that's for sure, and it gives us, like, this really cool opportunity to see birds and other wildlife closer than you might otherwise see it.
I love hearing the tone of Josh's voice when he says something like, yarrow, and how excited he is to see the yarrow. And
yes.
You know, that it was a monarch, but the egg, and then in the time over the weekend, you know, they were able to just monitor this whole thing. That was really exciting. I haven't seen a monarch yet.
Okay. I saw a few on my drive to Grand Rapids, but I don't know if I saw any in Grand Rapids, but they're there.
Okay.
And you know, the excitement about the spittlebug too.
Yeah.
Do you know about spittlebugs?
I think you're going to have to remind me. Because I feel like we've talked about it before.
Spittlebugs are, so if you're on a walk and you look at a plant and you notice like this little, it looks like a little bit of spit on there, just like these kind of white frothy bubbles on the stem of the plant. Those are from a spittlebug. And so they feed on the sap from the plant, but they protect themselves by like emitting these bubbles, this kind of frothy thing, so that they can't be seen. But if you go and like wipe away that froth, you'll see a little larva in there. But yeah, you can definitely tell when they start emerging in the early summer. Good phenology note there.
You know, I was mowing this weekend and I saw two. Okay. What is wrong with me? Went right out of my head.
Very, very relatable. This happens to me all the time. You were mowing. Spittlebug?
No, it's not. It's, Okay, I'm just going to ask because you'll know. And I was trying to do a mental thing to like work on my brain. Sam Gaida, what does he love?
Galls. Galls, burrows, and brooms.
So I'm mowing, and what do I see on some oak leaves? Two little galls, bright green little balls. And I went, I know what's happening there. That's a house for somebody.
Yeah. Oh, Sam would be so happy.
Yes.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. If, listeners, if you haven't heard Sam Gaida talk about galls, burrows, and brooms, I think we do have an earlier episode featuring one of his interviews.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. I have his guidebook here, which I need to take out and go look at things.
Sure.
But there's so much to be excited about out there.
There really is.
Including finding little oak apple galls.
You know, John Latimer this week was talking about he finally is seeing or feeling a few mosquitoes. And I was out in the garden most of the night last night. Still not mosquitoes, which I just ruined it. We're going to have them as soon as I get home, right? And John's also, what he had talked about before was that he thinks that's why birds have been so prevalent, because he said they're starving.
Yeah.
Or something, you know, I don't know.
At the feeders, you mean?
Yeah, at the feeders, yeah.
Prevalent at the feeders?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
And I don't.
Those insects come out and they've got other things to eat.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on, but I'm appreciating it just that I can be on the deck later at night and certain things like that. So. But yeah, John had a lot to say this week for the Phenology Report. That's our leader, of course, John Latimer. And he brought up something he was studying or went in the field to look at. And I knew immediately you were going to be on fire for this.
Absolutely. You know me well.
Yes.
You predicted accurately.
Yes. The four-toed salamander.
Yes, please.
We are... Well, we went through a May that was drier and cooler than average. And yesterday we celebrated the first day of meteorological summer, the 1st of June. And in part of that celebration, I took a long walk. Actually, I had the pleasure of... accompanying a couple of researchers from various and sundry state and federal operations out looking for four-toed salamanders. And the four-toed salamander is an uncommon amphibian here in northern Minnesota. And this time of year, they are in the vernal ponds, in the seasonal ponds. And they're using these seasonal ponds as a place to lay their eggs and to hang out. The female lays her eggs, and then she maintains a sort of a guard on the eggs while they hatch. And it takes about 4 weeks for the eggs to go through their development. Yesterday, most of the eggs we observed were between 1 and 3 weeks old. And it was just an eye-opening experience. But it, more than anything, points to the need to protect these vernal or seasonal ponds. So if you have some low spots on your land and they accumulate water and they maybe stay wet for part of the year, they are the home to not only the four-toed salamander, but they are also the home to some, in some cases, fairy shrimp, caddisflies, diving beetles, any number of microscopic little organisms that hang out in there. There are it is a complete biome that happens there. And when those ponds dry out, every one of those critters has evolved a strategy to allow it to continue. Ponds can go dry for several years, and sometimes the eggs that are down in the bottom in the mud are simply waiting for water. And when the water shows up, bang, they're back in business. Our explorations yesterday were just, as I say, a revelation to me, because I had not... I saw one four-toed salamander once when a child and I were in the woods, and we turned over a log, and there was a salamander right there. And I looked at it, and I thought, you're not a redback, and you're not a blue-spotted. That makes you, I don't know. Well, now I do. It is the four-toed salamander. The four-toed salamander, it's as big as the blue-spotted, but it is sort of a neutral brown on the back, and it is obviously four toes. The blue-spotted salamander has 5 toes on the front feet and 4 on the back. The four-toed salamander has 4 toes on the front and 4 on the back. So if you do run into one of these and you're not sure, take a moment and count the toes, but do it gently and try not to put the thing in your hand, because a lot of these amphibians live in a world where their skin is their contact with the world. And your oily, greasy, dirty hand can be a real problem for them. We, in our explorations yesterday, all wore gloves. Rubber or vinyl gloves, so that if we did touch something, we didn't leave behind a bunch of our pollution. So quite the day, just quite the experience altogether.
Okay. What a magical experience. I am so jealous. Wow. Be able to see those eggs is, as you mentioned, the four-toed salamanders are kind of fascinating, because instead of laying their eggs in water, the way that most, but not all, salamander species do, they lay their eggs in sphagnum moss, which keeps them moist. The moss is really good at retaining water. And then when the larva emerges from the egg, it just plunks right into the water where it can breathe, because the little larvae have gills. Salamanders are so fascinating. And, like, I think one of the very underappreciated little marvels of Minnesota. Have you spotted many salamanders near where you live?
No, not at all.
We have so many.
I'm maybe not looking. Maybe now I'm going to be looking.
They're also just really hard to find.
Okay.
They're primarily nocturnal. They really only move in ways where you can spot them in the spring. And then you have to be out, like, on a rainy night looking for salamanders crossing the road, which for some reason most people don't do.
Yeah. people named Charlie do, I think.
People named Charlie are absolutely out there. But we have... like a bunch of species. We've got the four-toed salamander, which John just mentioned. Its range is relatively small. Okay, Heidi, you're going to have to help me with ways people refer to areas of Minnesota that I'm not familiar with.
All right.
The Arrowhead region.
Yes.
What do you call that? Where is that exactly?
I would say the Iron Range. It's the, in the North Shore, you know, like the... think of the North Shore as that as an arrowhead, and so it kind of covers from probably Grand Rapids all the way up north and all the way up the shore.
So it's kind of that arrowhead-shaped tip of,
Cool.
Then the four-toed salamander lives kind of in the southwest area of the arrowhead region. It doesn't have a huge range, but for the four-toed salamander.
It's kind of Grand Rapids area, so.
But it doesn't go like all the way north in Minnesota. It cuts off kind of at, not all the way down in Duluth and Lake Superior, but if you go up like maybe a third of the North Shore is kind of the northern edge of that eastern range. So it doesn't go all the way up north. The red-backed salamander kind of lives all throughout the boreal forest, so what we kind of think of as the Arrowhead Range. The eastern newt, which is a really weird one. So it begins life, like most salamanders, as a aquatic little larva, transitions into a terrestrial juvenile called an eft, E-F-T, what an adorable term, and it lives terrestrially for, I think, 2 to 3 years. And then some of them decide, eh, I don't like it up here, transition back to an aquatic form and hang out for the rest of their adult lives underwater.
Wow.
And some of them remain terrestrial. Eastern newt. Meanwhile, the red-backed salamander just decided to entirely skip the aquatic phase and are born as terrestrial, like just very, very small terrestrial adults.
And okay, so, and by small, how small is the...
Like, just the tip of your, like, it can sit on the tip of your finger without any, without the tail or the head falling off. I don't know how well you can see this picture, but look at this little guy.
Little guy. Huh.
Yep. And then when they grow up, they're like 2 to 4 inches long and very, very thin.
Okay.
For the red-backed. And then the one that you're going to see throughout the state is a tiger salamander. It's our largest one. They're named tiger salamander because they're fierce little predators. And they've got little yellow spots, which give them the, also give them the name tiger salamanders. But they're pretty large, all the way from 7 to 13 inches. If you hold one in your hand, like the head and the tail are going to be sticking out of the palm of your hand by quite a bit. But we'll see these ones crossing roads sometimes. And often they end up in people's window wells. They get stuck there and can't get out.
Oh.
So that's a primary cause of mortality. So check your window wells, especially in spring and fall when they're moving around.
What's this source you're using to...
I'm using Reptiles and Amphibians of Minnesota by Stan Tequila.
Okay.
Or Tequila. Can I do some salamander fun facts?
Yes.
Do we have time?
Please, yes.
Yes. Yay, yay, yay. Okay. So as John mentioned, they have very sensitive little skin because like frogs, their skin is almost entirely moist. And they breathe through their skin. So even salamanders that have lungs, which are most of the terrestrial salamanders, minus the red-backed salamander, which doesn't have lungs at all and just breathes through its skin, even the ones with lungs will breathe in air through their mouth or nose, but then will exhale. Most of that carbon dioxide comes out through their skin, up to 80%. So they have this really interesting vasculature, very specialized red blood cells that like are so adapted to these really moist environments. And that's part of the reason why they're so nocturnal is that if they come out during the day, they run the chance of drying out, and a dry salamander is a dead salamander.
What time of year do you see salamanders? Spring and summer?
You're most likely to see them in the spring when they're moving to water to breed.
Okay.
The rest of the time, they're often underground. They're eating small insects, worms. Their larvae are eating a lot of mosquito larvae, so thank you, salamanders, for that. But yeah, they're pretty fierce predators. They have, the way that they feed is kind of, you know, frogs shoot out their tongues to grab insects.
Mm-hmm.
Salamanders do kind of the same thing. Like frogs, their tongue, instead of being attached at the back of the mouth, like ours is, they're attached kind of at the front. It has a shooting mechanism, much like a frog's does. And the tip of the tongue is covered in like this kind of sticky mucus. And the top of their mouth has a little glue pad. So when the tongue is in their mouth, it's got, it's producing mucus and it's touching against this glue pad. So when it shoots out at an insect, that insect adheres to it and gets brought back to the mouth. They have these tiny, tiny little teeth to help keep the insect or earthworm in there. And sometimes if it's like a big piece of prey, like an earthworm, they'll shake it, kind of like a dog will shake a toy, and that helps move it back in the mouth a little bit so they can swallow it. They're adorable. I love them. The other weird thing that frogs and salamanders do is their eye sockets are actually hard. And if you watch a frog swallow, you'll notice that its eyes kind of go from sitting kind of up on top of their head, kind of go into their body a little bit and then back up. It's because they're using their eyeballs to swallow. Their eyeballs Whoa. Have this musculature that allows them to move kind of into the mouth and throat cavity and help crush and shove the food backwards. Just nuts.
Yeah. And what are salamanders doing in the wintertime?
In the winter, they, the aquatic ones will winter in deep lakes. They do have some freezing ability. Particularly the blue spotted salamander is pretty darn good at freezing and recovering just fine. But tiger salamanders, many other terrestrial salamanders, just burrow deep enough underneath that they don't freeze. The tiger salamanders, some of the other ones, also spend the winter in like mammal dens and tunnels. So if you think about like an eastern chipmunk just hanging out with a salamander, so cute.
Wow. When's the last time you saw a salamander?
The last time I held a salamander was at Long Lake Conservation Center, which is, again, a magical place. I went there. I remarked to Dave McMillan, the manager there, that I really hoped to find a blue-spotted salamander, which I'd never seen in the wild before. Sure enough, that trip, I pulled over an old birch log and found 3 blue-spotted salamanders right there. It was the best. I was so happy. I've never seen one in the wild.
Wow. That's great.
Yep.
Well, I do want to say we got off on salamanders today on the Season Watch Pod, which is great. I learned more than I expected here. And the enthusiasm between you and John Latimer is amazing. But we did have 8 school reports this week, and they're all available at our website, kexc.org, yes. that you can hear a lot more of what students... Most of them, probably all of them, their final reports. We might be getting some from some camps at Long Lake over the summer, who knows? And possibly from some walks that John goes on and that kind of thing. But the main thing is we want you to get involved in this as well, whether it's a question, whether it's bragging that you saw something, send it our way. You can use SpeakPipe. It's available when you look at SeasonWatch at kexc.org or on your podcast platforms. And a really easy way to get involved and to... tell us more about the nature that you are seeing.
Last salamander fact before we go.
Yes.
How old do you think salamanders get?
4.
They live 10. I think the average for them was like 5 to 10 years.
Wow.
And my aunt had one. Oh, spotted salamander, 20 to 25 years. Tiger salamander, 10 to 25 years. Blue spotted, 5 to 10, 10 years. Yeah, they get pretty old. For like such a small creature, amazing. They regrow their tails, so we're like studying them to see if we can figure out how to, medical reasons, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Awesome critters.
In case we lose our tails, right?
Yeah.
You never
exactly.
know.
I hate that I lost mine. Sometime in utero.
Yeah. We do want to say thank you as always, because funding for our talkbacks, our phonology talkbacks, is provided by the Minnesota Environment Natural Resources Trust Fund. We also heard from our good friend who left us a speak pipe.
Yes, Josh Leonard.
There we go.
And then I was thinking about, you know, these cryptic species, and I was thinking about cryptic sounds that we may not necessarily be able to figure out even with the help of Merlin. And one of those was the white-tailed deer. So we have a white-tailed deer alarm call from an iNaturalist user named Minnakota and a fawn alarm call from Paul Driver. And then this next one is a little fawn calling for its mama.
Buddy.
Little baby.
tell others about the Season Watch podcast, share it, and share your observations with us. I'm Heidi Holton with Charlie Mitchell.
Thank you.
Support for Season Watch podcast comes from the Sugar Lake Lodge near Grand Rapids, a Northwoods setting on the shores of Sugar Lake, offering lodge rooms, cabins, and golf villas with on-site dining, a golf course, and access to the lake, trails, and seasonal outdoor recreation throughout the year. Plan your stay at sugarlakelodge.com.